Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast. This is the parenting podcast with a difference because it's all about parenting children with Send in all its forms. I'm your host, Gemma, and if this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome along. Thank you. There's like a whole bank now of other episodes that you could go back and listen to if you wanted. But thank you for choosing to listen today, wherever you are, whatever day it is that you're listening on. Maybe you're one of those people who has your notifications set, so you're listening on Monday morning when this has just come out. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. This week has been a strange week. Now, I'm recording on Wednesday, the 24th of September, and this Donald Trump press conference where he is linking autism to Tylenol, which is the American version of our paracetamol, is top of the news. It's top of my mind. And it was interesting. So if this is your first time listening, just a little bit of background on me. I have three children, two of whom are typical children. They're a little bit older. Alfie's 17 and Millie's 12. And then I have Leo, who is about to turn three on the 2nd of October, which makes me very sad. It goes too quickly. Anyway, it's not what we're here to talk about. He has Down syndrome. So while he doesn't have autism, or at least if he does, he's not showing any signs of that yet. Obviously, that can come at a later date. But I didn't expect the news to affect me as much as it did. I think my natural instinct was to go to a place of, God, if he was talking about Down syndrome and blaming women, classic, again, or it's something you've done, it's because you've taken this. I immediately felt how upset that would make me feel. And then I felt angry. And I feel like, and this is kind of the point of this podcast, the name of the diagnosis might be different and it might present its own individual challenges. But under this umbrella of Send, we are a community. And I like to feel like if you choose to be, we are all in it together. And hearing him wrongly, obviously, the science isn't there to back it up, what he's claiming. Firstly, that made me angry. But secondly, it was this whole thing of he's going to basically cure autism and eradicate it. And it's just offensive and upsetting. And my heart really went out to you if you are a mum of a child with autism, because I just think it must have just felt horrendous. You know, whatever emotion that brought up for you, I can't imagine that anyone with a child with autism read that and felt nothing. So today's episode was actually meant to be with somebody else. I've pushed that episode back a week because I thought it was important to get somebody on who is a mum of an autistic child and who really knows her stuff. And this is where Kirsty Bailey comes in. I scrabbled around on Instagram going, oh my God, I need to speak to somebody about this and get an informed opinion from somebody else. And that's exactly what I did. So Kirsty agreed to come on very short notice. And I have since been editing this episode to make sure that it went out on time. And she has some very interesting things to say. So this is an episode that I learn a lot from, specifically about communication and speech and language. My God, Kirsty really knows her stuff on this. She's done so many courses. She's actually a certified parent coach now. But she's talking about her son, Tommy, and her journey of being a mum to him. We also talk about her journey to getting a diagnosis of autism for herself. And of course, yes, we are going to talk about this press conference with Donald Trump and this narrative that he's pushing and her thoughts on that and what it means to her as a mum of a child with autism. So that's more than enough from me. Let's get into it. Kirsty, thank you for joining me at such short notice.
You're because, welcome.
Given what has been in the news about Donald Trump this week, I was very keen to get somebody on to talk to me about that for this episode. So this was a very scrambled, literally yesterday, the day before recording me going, please come on, I want to talk to you. So double thank you for that, Kirsty.
More than welcome.
So we will get on to that later in the episode, but I don't want to start by talking about that man. I would like to start by talking about you and your son, Tommy, because that's a nice thing to talk about. And that's really what I'm interested in with you.
Much better than I'm not gonna say the words I want to use.
No. You can swear on this podcast. It's fine.
Okay, good.
But let's start. Tell me a little bit about Tommy. And by that, I mean, like, what is he interested in? What does he like? Like, what kind of a little boy is he?
Yeah. So Tommy's 5. And up until just over a year ago, we considered him nonverbal autistic. And he was diagnosed with global development delay and speech delay disorder. But as of late, we are now considering him minimally speaking. He does struggle to communicate with people outside of the house. But there are a lot of things that people can understand outside of the house. So the words coming out has made him extremely cheeky, because we have now been able to find what was in there that we didn't know. We obviously didn't know was there before. So we're finding quite a cheeky little chap. He is absolutely obsessed with fruit and veg and sea creatures. Loves water play, anything to do with water. He will literally, on holiday, the paddling pools down here in the summer and stuff like that, he will go in and you struggle to get him back out. We always have a paddling pool in the back garden right up until like when it gets too cold and you can't really do it anymore. And then like sort of like end of February, the paddling pool's back out again. So we sort of have paddling pool from like February to October, really, because he just absolutely loves, if anything, just throwing toys in them, which is, you know, we do find them down the toilet and we have lost quite a few in duck ponds. So, you know, there is right now in Blackberry Farm in West Sussex, there is a couple of Elsas and an Ursula in the duck pond. So, you know, they are quite easily lobbed.
Fitting for Ursula to be in
exactly.
there, though.
Exactly.
That's
yeah,
in context.
Definitely. Yeah, exactly. He knew where it was supposed to be.
Do you find that when he's in the water, that regulates him? Because I have heard quite a lot of people saying that that can really help to regulate children with autism.
Yeah, I mean, Tommy is a master at self-regulation. And Tommy very, very rarely has meltdowns or has anything that really bothers him, because he's a seeker. So a lot of things don't bother him in general because he doesn't know they're there. But I think with him, the water, it's the cause and effect of the water for him more than the regulation. I think for him, he can see so much go on in the change in water. You've got, you know, the way it moves, the way he drops things into it. He likes to watch the way they fall down and things like that. So I think for him, it's a lot more cause and effect. But there's certainly an element of once he's in, he doesn't want to get out because he's now at a, you know, an optimal temperature and he's, you know, he's comfortable and it's nice, but he doesn't really sort of do the sort of laying down in it or anything like that and staying still. It's a lot of making as much noise as possible, splashing as many things in as possible and watching everything almost explode everywhere, you know, watching. And he will do things like he says, "Don't splash me, Daddy Pig," and then throws a toy and says plop, and he watches that plop. And for him, it's more about, you know, the visual of it, because he's a massive visual seeker.
So if we could just go back in time a little bit, when did you first suspect that Tommy might have autism?
So the autism side of what I suspected, something was different from 4 months, but it wasn't autism that I suspected. Okay. So I worked in childcare for 10 years. I'm a qualified early years practitioner. So I'd worked with a lot of kids and I only worked in the baby room. So I worked with, from 6 weeks old was the youngest child I ever cared for, until they were able to go into the toddler room, usually around 18 months old, some a little bit older, but 18 months was usually the amount. So having Tommy, the amount of children I'd seen, I'd weaned, I'd held, I'd played with, I'd, you know, all of those things. At 4 months, Tommy held his body completely alien to anything I'd ever seen before. He had a stiffness and a shake about him, which he still does now. That hasn't gone. And obviously now I can see what it was. And it is that it's this that he does. It's the visual stimming that he does, where he puts his hands in front of his eyes and he squeezes and his whole body goes tight and he like a shake. And that's what he was doing at 4 months old with his whole body. So the hands weren't going in front of his eyes. He was going like a starfish. and everything was going tight and everything was shaking. And I was just like, that's strange. Like, I've seen kids do it, but the amount he did it was just like this really odd. And then when he got to 6 months old and he didn't respond to his name and he didn't do any of the other developments, you know, like he didn't clap, he didn't bang toys on the table, it's like four years ago and my brain goes, what else was it he didn't do? And you know, it was, by the time he got to a year old, you could really see that he was still like a 2 month old. And it was at 9 months that we spoke to other family members and said, we think that Tommy might be autistic at 9 months old. And everyone literally went, well, we didn't want to say anything. So everyone had noticed he didn't acknowledge anybody. He had a vacant look all the time. It was as if no one was there. So people would come in and they'd be like, hi, Tommy. And it was as if they hadn't walked in the room. And that is not typical of a 9 month old. And that was the thing that everyone was kind of like, it's like he isn't looking at you. And yeah, so the moment we said it, everyone, there wasn't a single family member who didn't agree. And he was put on pathway at 16 months old.
And that's quite early, right?
Yeah, it was very, with Tommy, as I say, very, very obvious, very, very young. The meltdowns for absolutely no reason, the spontaneous laughter when no one was near him, he just wouldn't acknowledge anyone. He didn't acknowledge that anyone had walked in the room. You had to really get his attention. And he just wanted to stare at the same TV program 24/7, all day, every day. He didn't want to do anything. He would be in the jumperoo, and if you tried to take him out of the jumperoo, so the bouncing, which obviously now we know is he was regulating, if you tried to take him out of the bouncer and you tried to turn Olaf's Frozen Adventure off in the middle of June, he just absolutely, and we did do it, and we would try and move him around, but the way he reacted every single time wasn't typical of, I was quite enjoying that, I don't want to be moved. It was a lot more of, this is hell for me, please put me back where I was. And that was very, very obvious.
Sorry if you can hear that in the background. That's my son Leo, who was asleep for about 3 seconds before I came upstairs.
Obviously.
So he's obviously joining in. So once you started on the pathway, I know that this is different for everyone and it depends what part of the country you live in and all of that.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to get the actual diagnosis from that point?
Yeah. So our first appointment was 12 months, almost to the day. The next appointment was 2 months later. So the first one was at the hospital with speech and language and paediatrician. The 2 months later, it was in the home with just the speech and language. And then 2 months later, it was paediatrician, speech and language, and we got the diagnosis. So it was 12, 14, 16 months from start to finish, but it was only 4 months between first appointment and last appointment and diagnosis. And they did say in the first appointment, she said, we can't diagnose you from one appointment, but it is very obvious that Tommy is autistic, but we do need to go down the correct routes.
And how did you feel hearing that? You said you'd looked after, obviously, within your job in childcare, you'd looked after lots of babies. Did you have any particular experience of children with autism?
The first child I ever cared for was an autistic two-year-old when I first started. So it was very, and he was extremely, extremely high needs. He only ate yogurts. He would, like my daughter, right near the beginning, he grabbed hold of a chunk of her hair because she got in the space and, you know, it was, and she was about a year older than him. And she was just like, oh no, that was my fault, mummy. I got too close. It was my fault. So she was, you know, she was amazing at 3 years old. I've got a couple of friends who've got autistic children, but not on quite the higher support need as Tommy. Tommy at that point was really the closest I'd been to high support need as such. My cousin has a high support needs child, but we're not particularly close. So it's not like I had been around him a lot. I think I've met him once maybe. Yeah. But it shows the genetic link there, but on my mum's side of the family. But I hadn't really been around any high needs children. So it was all new to me, but I actually when Tommy went on Pathway, around, it was I think it was Boxing Day, so it was around the sort of time that the health visitor agreed to, that we would put him on Pathway. I had that day where I realised this was my life now, like that this was going to be, this wasn't going to be how I'd imagined it to be. Mm. And I sat and cried pretty much for 24 hours. And then I went, this is ridiculous. Snap yourself out of it. Nothing's going to change from crying. And I literally opened up on the 27th of December. I think it was in the evening. I opened up Google and started Googling autism and got extremely frustrated at all the stuff that I was reading that had no relevance to Tommy. Because autism's such a big spectrum, and you've got learning disabilities, you've got global development delay, you've got dyspraxia, like there's all these different things that coexist. And I was reading this stuff and I was like, well, that's not Tommy. You know, he's got no problem looking you in the eye. That kid will look deep into your soul. He doesn't care. He literally will come up to me and just puts his eye on my eye and just stares into my face. And I'm like, this is creepy, please stop. But you know, so he's the complete opposite. And I was reading all these things, I was like, none of this is relevant to Tommy. And obviously I was finding some stuff that was, but all it was really telling me was, this is the trait. And it's like, okay, that's great, but I already know that, I can see that in him. How do I deal with that? How do I help him? How do I support him? None of this is just explaining, this is what, you know, children with autism present like this and children with ADHD present like this. Well, I know that he's there in front of me, I can see that. Yeah. I need to know how to help him. And I just wrote into Google, what does the stim mean of hand flapping? Because Tommy was a big hand flapper at the time, and it brought up all about sensory profiling, sensory integration, and it was going through the 8 senses, whereas I thought there were 5. It told me that hand flapping. Yeah, there's 8 senses. It said that hand flapping was, in fact, a visual stim, whereas I thought it was more physical. And okay. And it was like, okay, this is where I need to go. And then I went down a massive rabbit hole. I became Alice in Wonderland on sensory integration. And I am now I'm now trained in sensory integration and sensory modulation, because I got that deep in the rabbit hole. I don't think I've ever come back up. I'm constantly doing more sensory training. And it just stumbled from there. And that was the best way that I could help him, was to know about him, not autism.
Yeah, I've spoken to a few mums who've said exactly that.
Yeah.
What exactly is sensory integration?
So sensory integration is about how our body responds to the senses. So sensory modulation is about what we do to help that. Sensory integration is how our body responds. So sensory integration is to do with the input that comes into the central nervous system. So if we take, for example, visual, so with Tommy, he's a big visual stimmer. He does the fingers to the eyes. He will put coloured things over the TV so that he can watch a programme in purple instead of the colour it is, and things like that. And he'll just mix it out, hold things up to the front of his face and then roll it around to the side and watch it in his peripheral. And that is all sending signals to the central nervous system to regulate it and to keep it calm. And he is only going to do that with the things that his body is craving. So this is why a lot of times people think that seekers are sometimes avoiders, but they're actually not. They're not avoiding things, it's just of no use to their central nervous system, because what they seek isn't that. So he's not a massive gooey person, like he's not a massive, doesn't really like getting paint on his hands and things like that. And that's not because he avoids it, that's because that has no relevance to his central nervous system. He doesn't need that. So he's like, oh, what's that? Like, I don't need that. I want the hard, like dry stuff, and I want to feel that pressure into my joints, and this soft thing is just not what I need. So it's all, sensory integration is literally about how the body is going to process all 8 of those senses to enable you to stay calm, or to go completely wild when you've had too much of it, or to drop right down. So it's all about how the body processes that.
And what are the extra 3 senses? Because I didn't know this. You're teaching me so much. I love this.
So the extra three are proprioception, vestibular, and interoception. Proprioception is about how we are aware of our bodies in space. So it is the input into our muscles and joints. So the best way that I always use this example because it's just a perfect way of explaining it. You know, if you pick up the kettle and your body automatically will use a certain weight and strength to pull that item up because it already knows how heavy that is going to be. But you don't know that the kettle is empty and you kind of go woof, up in the air and it hits the unit or something. And you're like, oh, I didn't expect that. And the other good one is when you step off a step and you think there's another step, but there isn't. And you sort of do that like little stumble and you go, oh, I thought there was another step there. That's because your body has that roadmap of how heavy that kettle should be, how much you should lift it, what force you should use. And that is already there in those muscles and joints. And when we are craving that proprioception or we're getting too much, I mean, proprioception is one we don't really overload on. We need as much of it as possible, but it's what tells us where we are in the room. Okay. And it's what keeps us in, you know, without bumping into things. So those of us like me who bump into things a lot, we have trouble with our proprioception. Then second, you have your vestibular, which is like a little spirit level in your ear. And it is what is protecting your head and keeping it upright. So it's how you know whether you're laying down, whether you're standing up. It's how you know if you're dizzy. And it tends to be when you get an ear infection, that is why you feel dizzy, because you've got, it's messing up the vestibular system, why you feel dizzy and sick. And that's there to protect our heads. It's just to make sure that we are upright, because that is our prime, what's the word I'm looking for? Risk factor is to protect our heads, because it's got our brain in it. And then lastly, you've got interoception, which is everything inside your body as to how it talks to you. So whether you have a stomach ache, whether you need the toilet, whether you're hungry, whether you're thirsty, whether, you know, what your organs are doing. And a lot of autistic people who have very strong interoception will say they can literally feel their kidney, they can feel their liver, they can feel everything that's going on inside because they have such strong interoception that they can feel that sort of deepness. But for the most part, it tells us, you know, whether we're sad, whether we're hungry, whether we're thirsty and things like that.
Going back to your Googling, I'd be interested to know how you found that initially, because so many people get told, don't Google when they get a diagnosis. And at the end of every episode of this podcast, I ask people for the best piece of advice they've ever been given. And a lot of people say that was the best piece of advice they were given is to not Google. And it's something that personally I am very, very hesitant to do, because with Down syndrome in particular, the first things that will come up are these very outdated images of what a child with Down syndrome will look like. And those things I find upsetting, and then it makes me angry, and then it takes you down that rabbit hole of negative emotions. Did you find that when you initially started to Google, or did you actually find that it was quite accurate?
Well, that first Google search where I just was like, Googled autism, yeah, that's exactly what come up. A lot of outdated stuff, a lot of stereotypical stuff, and it was of absolutely no use to me. So much stereotypical stuff. Even I knew enough about autism to know that some of that stuff was outdated. And that's why I became so frustrated. I was like, where on earth do I start? I have the internet, I have the World Wide Web, I have a computer in front of me, where do I start? And that's why when I then began Googling what's actually specific to my child, that was when I came up with the correct answers, because Googling autism as a whole, you're just getting everything and you're getting so much stereotypical stuff. But I think the biggest change for me was to actually take legitimate courses. And that was once I sort of realised, okay, so there's a lot of that goes into autism that revolves around sensory. Okay, who deals with sensory? Occupational therapists. Okay, Instagram. So I went to Instagram and I wrote occupational therapist, and I found occupational therapists. So these are qualified, trained people giving out free information. And I stumbled across an account called Everyday OT Island, which is run by Kev and Anya. I absolutely love them too. And I took their courses. So it was like £35 for sensory detective course, things like that. And that way I was being trained originally when I first started, and this was supposed to be for just me. I was being trained and helped by OTs. You know, I was effectively paying for private OT, really. It was just in a group session. And it was them who introduced me to sensory profiling. And that was where I then went off on my own and started learning more, and actually took sensory integration training with sensory integration education. So for me, the original Google search was exactly that, a load of stereotypical stuff and outdated stuff, and it had no relevance. But once I got down to the nitty gritty and I went to professionals, I was able to get the right information and then be able to go on and train myself. Whereas, you know, if you're just doing it, if I hadn't planned to do this for a living, then I probably would have just stuck with the courses with OTs and speech and language therapists. And I probably wouldn't have done the other stuff that I've done. But as I planned to do it for a living, I then went on to do more in-depth training. But the Google search was definitely not the one. Everything started to change in my head. But unfortunately, this is when I then realised I was autistic, and the reason I was digging so deep and studying so hard was because I'm autistic and ADHD, and I've hyperfixated on everything. And now that's why I do it for a living, because I now have so much information in there that's not necessarily relevant for Tommy, but could potentially help other people.
But isn't that a perfect example of it being such a positive thing that your brain works in that way?
Yeah, I've always been like it. As a kid, I was out in the garden in the summer and I was studying newts and frog spawn, and I was making my own magazines and books, and I was drawing, and I studied. And it wasn't until I got to secondary school and I realised that studying kind of gets you bullied, that it went downhill. And I then took up higher education again. Education, I guess, because I left school with nothing. But I took up education again when I was 21. And that's when I qualified as an early years practitioner. And since then, I've gone on every time I've had that, I want to do something new. I trained as a nail tech because I like studying and I wanted to do something different and things like that. I realized I'm not very good at it. So I'm all right, but it takes me a long time, and people don't want to sit and spend nearly 2 hours having the nails done, and I just mean that's without painting. That is just putting the gel on. So yeah, it's not for me. That one wasn't for me. But and even now, I've literally just done just finished my speech and language therapy assistant training, which I got a distinction for. And I've just finished that. And that was tough. That one was tough. I had to learn things about muscles in the mouth that I can't even pronounce. The buccinator muscle is the only one I think I can pronounce. I will go again. I'm going to start a play therapy training. I've done DIR floor time, intensive interaction. I just keep going every single time because it's interesting, if nothing else. It's so interesting.
Can I ask, did you find it made any difference to you personally getting your own diagnosis?
Yeah, so I'm actually not diagnosed. I'm in the middle of my process at the moment. So I don't have the diagnosis. I'm with the doctor at the moment in the middle of it. But I realised a year after I realised with Tommy, so probably 3 years ago, 3 years ago, I realised, and everything kind of dropped into place, and I've started changing things and doing things differently. And I actually said that I wasn't going to get diagnosed. I actually said, it doesn't matter. I now know, and I can change things, and my family all agree, and we can just do stuff. It doesn't matter. But at the middle of this year, I was like, I went through some health stuff in general, and at one of the appointments, I just said, I think it's time for me to get the diagnosis. And they were like, yeah, that's fine, and put me on. As I said, I think it was June I started the process. It's changed a lot of things about who I am and how I am, I've actually become more feisty, which I've started advocating a little bit more. You know, like sometimes you bite your bite your tongue for the silence. You know, so, what's that phrase? It's like it keeps the peace, but whose peace is it keeping? And I stand up for myself a bit more, like I've always have, but I'm a bit more like, oh no, we're not doing that here. Whereas before I would have just gone, yeah, okay, and just nodded and carried on with my day. Whereas now I do voice my opinion a bit more. Certainly hasn't helped with me being able to put my washing away. So nothing has changed there. But yeah, it's only recently in the last couple of months that I've started to have a bit of like resentment in my journey of saying, hang on a minute, if this had been known when I was a kid, this wouldn't have happened and that wouldn't have happened. And I missed this because of that. And, and it's literally the last, I'd say, 2 months since just after I went on to the list, actually, that I started to feel that I sort of look back at things at school and think that wouldn't have happened or that could have been like that or... with the way I study and everything since I left school, sort of think, where would I have been if I'd have stayed at school and I hadn't have worried about how I looked when I wanted to go to chess club in year seven, but by year eight, there was absolutely no chance you were allowed to do that. Otherwise, you know, you were a nerd, you were a geek and things like that. And it's, yeah, there's a bit of resentment there, but I guess I'll work through that one with my therapist, but it's not, that's been the only thing that's really been sort of tough, I guess.
Fellow chess club nerd here, by the way.
Oh, good, good.
But yeah, probably the same when it wasn't cool. Same with guides as well. I was like a guide for like same. 9 months and then I was like, oh God, I can't do this.
No, I did brownies right the way through. Yeah. And then, same as you, when you then go to do guides, like, oh, this isn't cool anymore.
I think what you've just said, though, I feel like probably a lot of adults who are getting diagnosed in their adulthood probably feel the same as that. Yeah. Obviously, it is going to make you look back and reflect and wonder how different things would be.
But if I got given the red and the blue pill for me to go back, I wouldn't go back. But it's just that little bit of resentment right now, which is, I think, is completely normal.
Oh, 100%. But I think also people didn't understand autism back then.
Especially not
the way
girls.
That they do now. Exactly. So maybe nobody would have been able to explain it to you in that way as they would do now.
I would have to be born now to be. I think if I was born now, it was very obvious at about four. Very, very obvious. There was a lot of imaginary friends. There was a lot of PDA going along on, you know, I think it was very, very obvious. I mean, not a lot of people are tying their friends up, pretending to be the witch in Hansel and Gretel and eating their friends at 4 years old. I'm just going to put that one out there. And I don't think I've ever come across anyone that can relate to that. I was definitely the strange one.
Sounds fun though.
It was great fun. I had fun. I'm not sure my friends did.
Yeah, maybe not for them. You are now a certified parent coach.
Yeah.
And you specialise in neurodiversity, communication and feeding.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of communication, I guess this has helped with Tommy, hasn't it? That's obviously why it's led you down that path.
Yeah, yeah. I started off looking into Gestalt language processing.
I'm going to stop you there. Yeah. Because you'd written this in a message to me. And I've said this on the podcast before. I love learning from people. Yeah. So I have Googled that. So I know what it means. But I'm going to assume that there are a lot of people listening that won't. So before you go any further, could you explain what that is, please?
So Gestalt language processing, there are two ways of learning language. And the one that we know of and is very, very common knowledge and we think that it's the only way is what we call analytical language processing, which is where we learn one word. We'll learn as kids, we learn mum, dad, cat, ball and juice, bottle. Then we start to learn the other words and we put them together and we sort of will go mum bottle, mum juice, dad ball, push door, things like that. And then that goes into sentences and builds up and then into grammar. Whereas with Gestalt language processors, it's literally the opposite way around. They learn four chunks of language that have a specific meaning. And if they don't have enough of those chunks of language, they can't break them apart when they get to stage two. So stage two for an analytical processor is putting two words together. Stage two for a Gestalt language processor is taking the front of a sentence and the back of a sentence and creating a new sentence. So for example, if a child would, like, we'll take Tommy. Tommy says, how about watermelon? And then he also says, let's go car. Now he can say, how about car? And let's go watermelon, for argument's sake. It's not a brilliant sentence, but because he can, those two sentences he's now able to use in stage two and take the front of let's go and the car and the watermelon. So let's go and how about, and he's able to interchange those. But in stage one, they are literally just using echolalia and repeating everything that you say, repeating things from TV shows, and quite often using these phrases that seem really out of context. So you might hear a child constantly say, let's go swimming, whenever they're at the front door and they want to go outside. And it's not because they want to go swimming. It's because they know that let's go swimming means they're going to go outside and they're going to go somewhere. And if they become stuck with these phrases, they will never move them into stage two, three, and four, and then into grammar. So we need to provide them with lots more of these scripts so that they can then break them down and create conversational language. And that's why for years and years and years, I mean centuries, we've always said, like, a child would say something and we'd be like, oh, it's just something they say. And it's not, it was their way of communicating. And we didn't know that until the early 80s was, I think it was 83, the first paper was written about Gestalt language processing. And over the last 5-6 years, it has boomed into having more and more people understanding it.
Do you know what I find really interesting there, though, is I wonder how many people, because I'd never heard of that before, but I wonder how many people have children who are doing that, but they don't realise that that's what they're doing. Because the example that you gave there of let's go swimming, now, if Leo was saying that all the time, as a parent, I would naturally just assume he wants to go swimming all the time. He's obsessed with swimming. He loves swimming. I don't think it would click with me that that isn't what he meant by that.
Yeah. And it's something that is in, when I did my training, it's actually one of the parts, and it brought me to tears, because they said by the time a child gets to 10, they actually sort of withdraw and stop trying to communicate because they realise that their efforts are no longer being acknowledged. So there are children out there, so many less now, we know more about it and people are getting the right help. But there are children out there who, as I say, who are constantly saying 10 scripts. And because the parents don't understand this, as you say, they're assuming it means something else, or they're ignoring it because they're like, oh, it's just something he always says. It doesn't mean that we're actually just going to the shop, and oh, it's just something he says. And by the time they get to 10, they stop saying these sentences because the communication isn't being accepted and it's not being acknowledged. And there's just no point in them continuing to communicate. So that's why we find a lot of, you know, there are so many reasons that people are nonverbal. It's not, you know, there are so many different reasons. But if your child is a Gestalt language processor and stuck in stage one, and that is the only reason that they're not speaking, they will potentially stay stuck forever and not move out of that. Tommy isn't just a stuck Gestalt language processor. He also has childhood apraxia of speech. So there is another issue there that we have to work with. So it isn't the only reason that children are nonverbal, but it does, like, get me right in the heart sometimes when I think, God, there are so many children, especially over the centuries, who never learned to speak just because they were a stuck GLP and we didn't understand that. And that's, you know, that's why I'm so passionate about it, because the more people who know about it, that might not be the reason their child's not speaking. But if they use the Gestalt language processing strategies, then we're giving them that one more extra chance to be able to speak. Because if that is the reason, we're going to be able to move them out of stage one into stage two. If it's not the reason, then we need to go down another route, like motor problem, motor planning issues or executive functioning issues, sensory processing disorder, childhood apraxia of speech, because there are so many different learning disabilities, different reasons. But the GLP side of it, it feels like such a simple, we just change the way we talk to our kids at home, can be such a simple change that for a small percentage, or, you know, well, I wouldn't say a small percentage, but not a large percentage of children, could change their ability to speak or not.
There was a new stat came out recently that said that 1 in 5 children in England schools have some form of SEND. And the thing that the majority of them needed help with was speech and language. So, you know, you're not talking about an insignificant number of people there.
No. It's still a large number, but in that large number, you have so many different reasons. You have phonological disorder. You know, there are so many different reasons that a child may not be speaking. But out of those, if we know 85% of autistic children are gestalt language processors. So you could have...
A high percentage.
It's a high percentage, yeah. And that's only estimated because... we don't know. Some people out there may have gestalt language processors and we don't know. So that is the best estimate that we can get. I have only met a couple of children who are analytical processors, who are nonverbal. So, you know, we're talking 85% of autistic people, and some of those are verbal and they don't get stuck and they do just go through the phases. I'm a gestalt language processor and you could not stop me talking by the time I was 2. But I was also quoting big chunks of Shakespeare in the middle of the doctors because I had so many scripts in my head. So, you know, I learned to speak very early and in big amounts. In chunks I shouldn't have been able to do, but I was memorizing these big chunks. So 85% of autistic children are GLPs. And then when you look at how many are nonverbal, using those practices will just give them that little bit of a, right, it's not GLP that's stopping them from speaking, it's something else. Or it was GLP that was stopping them from speaking, or a bit of both.
It's interesting, though, thinking back to you saying about going on these courses, because kind of understandably, when you know those stats, I would assume that this is quite common across the country. But certainly in Liverpool, where I am, speech and language has one of the longest waiting lists. But I thought this when you said it, that obviously whenever you did them previously, you've gone on, you found people to help, you've done these courses, and it's kind of taking the power back then, isn't it? Rather than waiting to get to the top of that waiting list. And then when you get there, you have, and I understand that there is a process, you know, we're very lucky to have the NHS, but there is a process that you have to go through. And a lot of the time it is a long process, and then you might not get seen, you know, once you get to the top of the list after that initial referral meeting, then it might be weeks or months. And I really like the idea of what you said of being able to take that power back, you know, hope, you know, alongside what the NHS is able to offer, but just to learn more and be able to help your child, I guess, more on your own terms, certainly in terms of timing and waiting.
Well, I think one of the things I think people do forget, because we get so sucked into the battle and so sucked into fighting, that we kind of, I think sometimes we forget what we're fighting for. And we're fighting for the support, but the support isn't to have somebody in your house doing it for you. The support is going to be somebody teaching you how to do it at home. So, you know, you, no matter how you learn that, you can learn that in lots of different ways. There are lots of speech and language therapists who do gestalt language processing courses online. I have a guide that you can download and you can read it whenever you like. You know, it's you. There's so many of us that provide a way of you being able to know that information at home. And you can do it on Google, you know, as I said, and I hate to say it again, but you can Google speech and language therapist gestalt language processing and find one in your local area who's trained in gestalt language processing, and they may have a course on. And that course is going to be exactly the same as you having 6 sessions and them playing with your child, but teaching you how to do that at home.
And that, I would assume, would be a more financially viable option for a lot of people than paying for those courses of private speech and language.
Absolutely. I mean, off the top of my head, I think it's a minimum of about £90 for 1 private speech and language therapy session, which is, you know, it's a big amount.
Yeah.
I know speech and language therapists who have courses and have ebooks. And again, around £25 to £35. So it's a big difference.
Okay.
My ebooks range from £15 to £35. As I say, there's £25 to £35. So you are literally more than halving the cost of one appointment to have all that information at home. And you read through it, you learn how to do it, you learn to implement it, because that is effectively what a speech and language therapist is going to do. Then it's not a magic, it's not, you know, they're not going to sit in front of your child and do something that you can't do at home. They are going to do something with your child while you watch, and then they're going to show you how to then imitate that at home.
Yeah.
And you can do that while you're on the waiting list. And I'd never tell anyone not to sit on a waiting list. Stay on the waiting list. You probably need it for documentation and things like that. You need the diagnosis and stuff. So we have to stay on those waiting lists. But in the meantime, early intervention is key. The earlier that we can support our kids, the more impact it's going to have. And there is so many professionals out there who are sharing this information for free and for small charges. And you don't need to go out and pay for a private speech and language therapist when these same therapists are producing workshops and courses and ebooks and things like that to help you at home. So there are, you know, by all means, pay for those one-to-one sessions. But if you are somebody who can't afford that, there are other options.
Okay, Kirsty, we're going to have to talk about it now. This news of this narrative that Donald Trump is trying to push about autism and paracetamol and the link. As a mum of a child with autism, well, and you also are on the path to getting that diagnosis, how did that make you feel when you initially heard that?
Laughable is my first initial, I'm not going to lie. Like, the anger set in a little bit after. Originally, it was just like, what on earth is this bloke talking about now? And I knew it was coming because obviously he's been, it was like March or something, he started saying, oh, we're going to have the, and it was like, right, he's obviously going to link it to Tylenol, and he's obviously going to link it to his mate's drug. So to push his mate's drug. And he's now sitting here saying that he's going to find the thing that all these medical people have been studying for decades. But he, with no medical background, is going to find the reason. And it's like, well, we already have the reason. We're fine with that reason. And the way he came out in the press conference with that, like, he was with the vaccines as well. And he was saying, I feel we shouldn't give the vaccines. It's like, okay, well, I feel like I need a McDonald's tonight, but it doesn't mean that I should have one. Like, that's your opinion. It's your feeling that you've given no scientific facts. You've given no medical facts. You've just said, I feel. And I watched one this morning that he was talking about hooking up babies to vats of vaccines. And I was like, does he think before he speaks? Like, does he have this image of us having babies and there's this like row, a bit like the Matrix, of everyone hooked up to this vat being pumped? He was literally said words pumped full of 80 diseases in vats. And I was just like, why are we listening to this?
Ridiculous, isn't it? I think one of the things that got me, and you know, naturally I've, you know, related it back to Leo, because if he's there with autism, I'm sure Down syndrome and other things like that,
exactly,
aren't going to be far behind.
No.
But it was it's making me feel quite emotional thinking about it, but one of the things that really got me was this idea that he was going to eradicate autism and cure it. And that's just downright offensive.
It is, yeah. I mean, I've actually ended up having an argument on Facebook yesterday with somebody I've known for about 30 years, and I've ended up blocking them and using a lot of choice words, going on about damage. And it's like, how dare you? You know, you are literally using the term damaged about my child. I don't care about me, like, whatever. I'm big enough and ugly enough to deal with crap. But you are literally saying that my child is damaged, vaccine damaged. And it's like, you don't get the right to speak like that. You know, I get that stuff off of strangers on the internet, off of trolls who are trying to get a rise. Yeah. But of somebody I've known for 30 years, like, who the hell do you think you are? And it just, it opens your eyes up to how people see the world. Yeah. And this is the problem with Donald Trump's narrative and JFK Jr., because he said originally, when they said about trying to find the reasons and that, it was his first argument, RFK's, was these children will never pay taxes. And that was his first reason for wanting to find. They'll never pay taxes, they'll never play a baseball game, and they'll never write a poem. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure you don't play baseball. I'm pretty sure you don't write poetry. And I'm pretty sure you hide your taxes. And you're coming at disabled kids. And the first thing you want to say is the reason you want to find a cure for autism is because they don't pay taxes. Well, I'm sorry that we're all such a bloody burden. Like, it's insane.
So I do just want to reference the science here, because this isn't just our opinion. Oh, he's wrong. As far as I'm aware, this is one of the biggest studies into autism. This happened last year and included 2.5 million children in Sweden. So this is a huge study. And this is the main science that people are quoting to prove that he is wrong. Now, in Sweden, which I didn't realise, a mother's use of paracetamol during pregnancy is actually added to your medical records. So in Sweden, they can actually tell who has had paracetamol when they're pregnant and who hasn't. And just in case you've been living under a rock, Tylenol is the American brand for paracetamol. So it's the same thing. Now, in this study in Sweden, the researchers did find a marginal increase in the risk of autism and paracetamol use by the mother. However, and this is where his evidence falls down, when they included data for siblings born to the same mothers from pregnancies where she took no paracetamol, the apparent link disappeared, meaning that in one pregnancy, which resulted in a child who has autism, she took paracetamol and the other one she didn't. So the link has gone.
It's gone. The minute you've got, yeah. And it's this is the thing. It's that difference between causation and correlation. One of the ones that I love that people bring out is in Australia, when ice cream sales go up, so do shark attacks. And it's like, does that mean that ice cream sales are the reason we have more shark attacks? No, it's because there's more people on the beach. There's more people in the water. So there are more people buying ice creams. There are more people in the water. And just because something is going up at the same time, I mean, I have seen so many amazing examples recently of people showing different things that have gone on the rise at the same rate as autism, which would have absolutely no, like, it'll be like toy sales or something, like, or garden equipment. And it's like, so are we saying it's that? Because that is the only thing that study did, was say, oh, yep, and these parents had this and these parents had that. But then when you took their, like it says with the siblings, that link just dropped right off, because it wasn't the causation in the first place. It was just a correlation.
And the other thing that's worth noting here is that medically, women with autism are more likely to suffer from some kind of pain during pregnancy, whether that's migraines. I know that there's a link between autism and migraines, isn't there? So there are going to be women with autism are more likely to have to take paracetamol, but then it's the genetics, isn't it? That ultimately is the cause of autism, is genetics.
Yep. Exactly. So, we are definitely more likely, I want to say, to be more dramatic, because that's kind of how I feel it is. You know, like, I'm in particular, I mean, I'm covered in tattoos and I fall asleep while I'm having a tattoo. But if I get headache, the entire house knows about it. I am bedridden. I've got towels on my head. I've got, oh, woe is me. It just affects me in a different way, because I think a lot of the time it affects my autonomy. I didn't ask for this, and I had things I wanted to do and now I can't. So it rips all my spoons away and I end up just falling down into a pity party. And I know so many autistic people and those with ADHD who fit that criteria of, when I'm ill, it's like a bomb's gone off, you know, and I feel awful. And I would take paracetamol or whatever to feel better. So like you say, in pregnancy, those things are heightened.
There are also risks to your baby with fever in pregnancy is another thing that is important to mention here. And obviously paracetamol is what would bring a fever down. Now, the health secretary, Wes Streeting, his comment on this is, and I quote, to not pay any attention whatsoever to what Donald Trump says about medicine. And he said, I trust doctors over President Trump, frankly, on this. I think what really gets me, though, is that I think any send mum, regardless of the diagnosis, I think I'm probably right in saying that the majority of mums at some point have felt some kind of guilt. Gone, is it something that I've done? Why has this happened? Have I caused this? And I think I've had a lot of conversation. I certainly had that. And the conversations that I've had are, yes, that's a valid way to feel. However, you're wrong. Like, no, of course this isn't your fault. No, you have done nothing to cause this. And that is undoing all of that, isn't it? Because if you're already thinking, oh God, did I do something? And then the president of America is going, yeah, you did actually. You did, yeah, yeah. It's your fault. Yeah,
it's your fault. And this is what it feels like. It's like in the 50s, we had refrigerator mothers. Yeah. There was a doctor, I never remember his name, doctor, and he was a psychiatrist, I believe. And he was going around doing lots of interviews and things, telling everybody about how it was the mother's fault. They were cold, and he dubbed the name refrigerator mother. It had been mentioned before that, but this particular doctor was doing a lot of marketing on it to boost his career. For 20 years he did it, yeah. Until the 70s, and he was boosting his career, trying to get himself somewhere, trying to get noted. And by the time the 70s came, that damage is massively done. But we started to get things to say, oh, actually, no, it's this, it's that. And some of that started to be removed. So we now need something else to blame. It's lazy parenting. So in the 80s, it was your mollycoddling, your, you know, take that dummy away. You just want your child to be a baby longer and things like that. So it just got shifted back onto the mums again, just with a different name. And now it's exactly the same situation in 2025. I feel like I'm in an episode of Black Mirror. Like, yeah. We've literally just gone back. He might as well have just stood there and said, look, my friend has a drug and I need to sell it. So I'm going to call you women. Once again, it's always blooming women.
Always.
I'm going to tell you women that it's something you did. And I'm going to tell you women not to take it anymore. And then I'm going to worry. Well, he's probably not going to worry about the amount of women who are then in hospital, bumping up the fees of care because they can't bring their temperature down, putting more money into the medical system and into big pharma and things like that by going to hospital when they could have just taken two paracetamol at home.
Yeah.
It's just insane.
And also, the thing that makes it laughable here is that autism was first recognised in the 40s. Early 40s.
Yeah.
Tylenol wasn't invented until 1955.
55, yeah.
So there you go.
Why can you ever say that's the cause? Yeah, and I've had a lot of people say to me, oh, he's not saying it's the cause. He's saying it's one of the causes. But how? What? It can't have been caused for hundreds of years. And then suddenly, and they're trying to say that the Tylenol has made it worse. No, the diagnosis process has made it worse in your eyes. It's made it better for us. We're all sitting there going, this is so much better. But the rest of society, they're, oh, that burden has got worse, hasn't it? And we're like, no, this is better for us. We just need more support. And we're getting it.
Kirsty, I always finish the podcast with the same two questions.
Yeah.
First being, what is the best piece of advice that you've been given along the way?
To cry and move on. There is nothing wrong. Like, sometimes I'll sit here and a kid will go past on their bike and Tommy can't do that. And you feel that sinking moment. And that's okay. Cry. Have that moment, but just don't stay there.
I love that, because when we were in therapy, we were talking about what acceptance meant. And acceptance doesn't mean, oh my God, I'm absolutely fine with this 100% of the time.
Yeah.
It means it means in general, yes, this is fine, and accepting that there will be moments where it doesn't feel fine. And I like
we
that.
Don't
stay there, move on.
Even people with typical kids, they don't love their kids 100%. Well, they love their kids 100% of the time.
Like
they don't like their kids 100% of the time. I got that round the wrong way then. They don't like them 100% of the time. That's okay. You don't stay there though, do you? You don't like them for 10 minutes or an hour or whatever, and you're like, God, you're doing my head in. But you love them, and that's okay. And it's exactly the same thing. Be a bit sad. But just move on.
Great advice. What do you know now that you wish you'd known when you got Tommy's diagnosis?
I think the biggest thing would be that no one was going to save me. I was going to have to, or save him, should I say, because I have a lot of people ask me a lot, how do you get a diagnosis for this? How do we get a diagnosis for this? Because they believe that they're going to get support once they get that diagnosis. And I wish somebody had told me at the beginning when I was fighting for the diagnosis that my fight was just going to lead in a piece of paper and no one was going to save us. I had to learn it myself. I think that would be, that would be it.
That's interesting. Thank you for that. Yeah. Now, Kirsty, before you go,
yeah,
there's a lot of help that you're offering people.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how people can get in touch with you. What's the easiest way to contact you and see all the things that you're offering?
Yeah. So any of my social medias, so Mama and Tommy, they all have the link in my bio that will take you to my website or to my Stan store. So my Stan store has everything that I offer. That is the one-to-ones, the ebooks, the workshops, and the website has an option that you can send a message to me. So if you want to have a chat or anything, and I also do little sort of 10-15 minute free appointments that people can just have a chat and see if I can help them, what it is that they're struggling with, what we could possibly do to support. And I do that, 10-15 minutes. Sometimes I can answer questions for people and they don't actually need support. And it was something I could just say, look, you just need to go and do this. And it's a lot easier than that. Or it's, no, this is what we could look at doing. And then people then go on to book on booking sessions that way. So yeah, website or my, so Mama and Tommy Instagram and TikTok, and mumaandtommy.co.uk will take you to my website.
Fabulous. Now, I'm going to put all of those links in the show notes. So if you're driving or you missed that and you haven't got a pen handy, don't worry. You can just check the show notes on this episode and you will find all of that there. Kirsty, I've loved chatting to you. Thank you so much.
And you, Gemma. Thank you so much for having me.
I loved that chat. I think my favourite episodes where I learned something, and honestly, I learned so much, particularly about speech and language from that chat with Kirsty. And also, I just thought she was really nice, clearly very intelligent. And I love the fact that she's gone out of her way to learn so much to not only help Tommy, her little boy, but also is then using that to help other people as well. And I'm sure she's helped many a person. So like I said, the info on how to get in touch with Kirsty on her TikTok, Insta and website will be in the show notes. And yeah, another fabulous guest. I really hope you enjoyed that chat as much as I enjoyed having it. So that's it for another episode of the Send Mum Club. As always, I'd be really grateful if you could follow, subscribe, hit the icon to let you know when new episodes are coming out, however it is that your podcast app works. That doesn't cost anything, by the way. It just lets more people find the podcast. And it will also let you know when the next episode is out. Next week's guest, I am very excited for you to hear, is actually conversation that I had over the summer, so it's been waiting on my laptop for probably a couple of months now to go out. So that will be landing next Monday. Well, I suppose it depends when you're listening to this episode. All of the episodes come out 6 a.m. Monday morning, so I will see you back here next week.